We have a roving microphone here to take your questions, and Kelly would be glad to answer them, field them. So if you have a question, let me see your hand, and I'll bring the mic to you. Okay, we have one back here.
I wonder if you could help us understand a little bit, or to the extent that it's appropriate, your work in the culture that has no concept of God, China, and how what your mission there is.
So that's a good question. And one of the interesting things about doing work in cognitive psychology of religion in China is this is the test case. China's the test case because people claim that China is a culture without belief in God. So you hear these things stated often. The Chinese aren't religious. The Chinese don't believe in God. But it's not true. It just plain is not true. And a lot of academics in China don't believe in God. The government has tried to force atheism on an entire culture. And as soon as the government stopped doing that, religious belief just shot up like crazy. Christianity and Islam are the fastest growing religions in China, and they're growing in leaps and bounds. I'm writing a book with an Oxford professor on early China, and we're writing about it's called China's High God, and it's there in early China. It's there throughout China. One of my friends in China, a professor, heard me give a talk something like this in China, and he said, "This isn't true. You won't find any. If you go to China, you won't find, you won't verify any of this stuff. The work in the cognitive psychology of religion, it only tells you about Western culture. It doesn't tell you about China." So he did a big study on afterlife beliefs. He thought you would find out that the Chinese don't have any, and he found out they do, and except for maybe some university professors who've been encultured not to believe, it's nearly universal in China. And he published one of the first papers in the cognitive science of religion. It completely changed his mind. The Chinese are religious, he decided. They have really substantial afterlife beliefs. I'll just say one quick anecdote. One sociologist in the 30s or 40s had been told the Chinese aren't religious. And then he went there and he saw these temples everywhere full of gods. And he didn't know how to process this information. How is it that they could not be religious and have so many temples and so many gods? And in the end, the force of his experience overcame the kind of common mantras you hear about the Chinese. And they just aren't true. The Chinese are religious. How might you look at it? God did not leave himself without witness in China. He didn't let a great and vast culture have no knowledge of him.
All right, I see another hand up here.
I'm interested in how what you've studied has affected your thoughts on evangelism.
Well, that's a good question. So, so here's one way it's affected me. If you become friends with people from China who for 50 years have been told there is no God, they've been institutionally force-fed atheism, it makes me hope that God is a lot more generous than I would have thought 30 years ago, that God is a lot more salvifically generous. Here's another thing that struck me. If because of some brain defect, you couldn't believe in God if you wanted to, you can't want to. You don't have wants, really. I hope God is salvifically generous. So learning about, in a sense, our creatureliness, our frailness, our contingency, it's expanded my sense of divine grace. I just can't look at people that didn't grow up in West Michigan and have every advantage with respect to Christian belief and say God's going to look at them in the same way as He looks at me. I just can't do it anymore. I constitutionally can't look at people and think God's going to send them to hell forever. I don't see how in most cases they could come to the belief. So, I've brought lots of students to come to the U.S. and study and learn about God, and I've organized conferences in China for years and taught defending belief in God, so I do the best I can to... You have to do it given the limitations. You can't go over there and be an evangelist, but you can go over there and get people to think, and people have gotten to think.
The observation that personhood really trumps the materialist explanation that one would conclude in theory of mind and agency, ADD, leads to belief that it's all driven by evolutionary factors and it's a false positive that there's God. I wonder if you could speculate. Last week, I think it was Paul Kortenhoven was talking about it, how in Africa you don't have the same barriers, you don't have the same obstacles of people believing, because there's much more belief in agency. And in our postmodern and technological world, it seems like personhood really has decreased, and we're not willing to attribute personhood to our neighbors anymore. Wondering what your thoughts are about the value of personhood and how it speaks to the modern university professor and atheist, when materialism is really the dominant philosophical orientation.
So that's a tough question, one I don't know that much about, but to me, the interesting thing that it shows is we're not determined by any of these things to any particular beliefs, that our culture can overcome nearly any of these sort of natural inclinations or inclinations that we might have. And so having a culture that's so impersonal, you know, how many of you know your neighbors' names? You know, how many of you... It's so different from when I was growing up as a kid. And just one example about how our culture can overcome this, most of us probably don't shoot up most of the time when we hear a sound in our house, because most of us feel fairly safe. We do have an agency detecting device, and it is pretty sensitive. It's set at a hair trigger, but we feel so safe. Our culture is so relatively safe that I'm sure someone on the plains of Serengeti, who's in life and death struggle for existence, hasn't been enculturated into thinking the world is safe. And so that cognitive faculty, it's in both of us, but we've been encultured to ignore it most of the time. And we can be encultured to ignore our agency, theory of mind, and not to treat people as humans. So... it seems to me having kids spend so much time playing video games and not getting out and hanging around with other kids is not a good thing. There are probably lots of ways that we could describe this if I were a more cultural and broader, more visionary thinker, but I'm not. I just sort of focus on little narrow things. And
heard of a couple of instances, well, I don't know how many, but of a confirmed... confirmed atheist who, through scientific study or something like this, has come to a belief in God completely, you know, completely switched sides. Comment on that?
One point is we don't know how indisposed cognitively any individual is or isn't towards any particular belief, and we don't know what experiences they might have. There's a famous journalist, so I can't remember his name, who was a communist when it was really cool to be a communist, And so like in the 50s and 60s, but I can't remember his name. And so he thought people were just like human bits of sausage. That's what a human being was, a human-shaped sausage. Nothing special about human beings. It's just matter takes this shape sometimes, and it takes this shape sometimes, and sometimes it takes this shape. Nothing special, no dignity to human beings, no God to give them dignity. And then he had a baby, and the second he saw the baby, he believed in God. And he could no longer believe that there's not some intrinsic value to human life. And these, that to me, that's a sort of the universe's vow, sort of throbbing, and somebody gets it. Someone gets it. Yeah. So, but the fact is, after a certain age, it's hard for people to change beliefs. Most of us get pretty sick. Aristotle thought we were all ruined by age 21. At age 21, there's no changes whatsoever. He didn't have a big theory of divine grace, but there's some truth to it. You know, we get set in our ways, and they're really hard to change. And sometimes they're hard to change because we have a sort of cognitive stance, and we don't all have the same one. We have some fairly universal cognitive faculties, but they're better in some people than in others.
Have you worked with any of the neuroscientists or neurology people, the brain people, in perhaps doing any fMRIs or any types of those studies where one sees the lighting up of the brain neurons when we get into this, where there is a physical definite area in the brain that accepts these ADD and theory of mind areas where they light up?
Yeah. And by yeah, I mean no. I've read a lot of the literature. I've written a chapter in a book on this. I don't know how many of you have heard of the God helmet. There's one of the neurologists that works in this area has this helmet that can stimulate. It's not the theory of mind and ADD portion of the brain. It's the emotion part of your brain that people tend to associate with religious experience. And so he puts it on nuns who've had ecstatic experiences and monks who've had ecstatic experiences. And then they figured out what part of the brain was being stimulated. And then he figured out a way to stimulate that part of the brain. And so he alleges that he can create the experience of God, artificially create the experience of God. Richard Dawkins made a pilgrimage to this guy because he wanted to have a religious experience. He wanted to see what it was like. So he went and put the God helmet on, but he didn't have one. And it turns out lots of people don't have them. And suggestion is super powerful in psychology experiments. It's unbelievably powerful. You can get responses that you want by raising an eyebrow. And so people have done these experiments in some country in Scandinavia, and they haven't been able to replicate them. So no one knows that this is, it seems to me there is going to be some part of the brain that is operative when people have religious experiences. That just seems to me undeniable. But no one knows if anybody's been able to create a religious experience, and the studies are completely open. Nobody really knows. I'd say I'm, and one thing I recommend reading, it's kind of fun. I haven't done the studies myself, but there are people who are really skeptical about all sorts of claims based on fMRIs. They look really scientific. And so if someone does it and they show you a picture, and it's hard not to believe, but read Neuroskeptic. There's a blog where neuroscientists go on and say we need to be really cautious about what conclusions were drawn. We don't know. The brain is really mysterious, and we don't know a lot about it yet. And that's one lesson I'd like people to take from this. We just don't know that much about how the brain works. We know a lot more than we did 50 years ago, a lot more. It's unbelievable what people know. And we know about that much.
I wanted to see what you thought about an article that was written in Newsweek last fall about, I think he's a neurosurgeon who died and had an experience of heaven, and he said his brain waves, there was none. It was like flat, apparently. And yet, in spite of that, he had this incredible experience of angels or God.
So I just wrote about that. And it's Eben Alexander. He's a Harvard neurosurgeon. He's a Harvard neurosurgeon. He taught at Harvard. And now he's a neurosurgeon, I think, in Virginia. And he had a bacterial meningitis started munching on his brain. And he went into a coma. And he was in a coma for 7 days. And his neocortex, the part that makes you human, where your thoughts, feelings, and desires are, evidently was at zero. And doctors were monitoring him. And during this, he had a near-death experience where he said a woman guide came and took him through. It was initially kind of muddy and ugly and dirty, and then brought him to the light where he felt warm. And then there's a big description. Newsweek magazine had a cover article on it, and then he wrote a book, Proof of Heaven. And there, eventually, he comes face to face with God. And he wants to stay, and the woman says, no, you have to go back. And then he wakes up just like that. And his brain's completely fine. That's the other interesting thing. For 7 days, his brain was completely, except for the stuff in the back that keeps your heart pumping, the rest of his brain, he says, was at completely shut off. So there wasn't a place to have experiences. So he said he had brain-free consciousness is what he had. He was roaming around a spirit world, which to him was more real than the physical world. But he had to come back, and he came back to tell people. So I use it in the opening chapter in this book that I hope to write on cognitive science of religion, because a lot of people said this is the worst article Newsweek has ever published. Sam Harris, famed atheist, you know, said this is the stupidest thing he's ever read. And Oliver Sacks, this is the interesting thing, Oliver Sacks says it was a hallucination. He just published a book called, I think it's called Hallucinations. So here's the interesting thing. I'm not going to tell you what I think about it because I really honestly don't know, but I use it to play off. Oliver Sacks one time hiked up in the mountains alone. You know Oliver Sacks, the man who mistook his wife for a hat, the awakenings guy? He's a neurologist, writes really cool books about the brain. He was up hiking, I think, in Norway alone, and he came face to face with a bull, which he had been warned not to get near, but he did. And he, as soon as he saw the bull, he ran and he tripped and he fell down and he broke his knee. And he was alone and he had to walk down the mountain, and it got really cold. It was either walk down or die. And he made he took his umbrella and he made a little splint here in his anorak, and he started to walk down, but he had a long ways to go, and his pain was really tremendous. And he got to a river, which he didn't see how he could possibly cross with a dysfunctional leg. And a very clear and distinct voice told him, find a nice even pace, push on, you'll make it. And he was at a point where he was ready to give up. He thought he was going to die. And this voice spoke to him. And so then he explains it away. He criticized Eben Alexander's experience. He explained away his own hearing of this voice. But I did a little detective work, and I'm pretty sure that Oliver Sacks is high-functioning autistic. Why do I think that? He has what's called face blindness. He has the inability to see people's and remember people's faces. So he can see his mother and not know it's his mother. If he smells her, he'll know it's his mother. He knows her smell, but he can't recognize his face. When he gets up in the morning and looks in a mirror, he doesn't recognize himself. He doesn't remember faces. That's very commonly associated with autism. He's lived alone his whole life. He says it's painful to be with people. And there's a big list. And then, so I'm sort of diagnosing him as autistic. And he said, I found an interview where he said, many of my friends think I have Asperger's, but, and then he says he don't. And I assume many of his friends are psychologists. So anyway, my point is he may have heard the still small voice of God and been unable to say thanks. So I just use them to contrast how you can explain away You can use the psychology to explain away either person's experience, but it doesn't settle it. You don't know if Eben Alexander had it, even if you know that there might have been neurons firing in his brain unbeknownst to him. You don't know if they weren't firing because he was having a glimpse of the next life. So you just can't tell based on the psychology. But anyway, I use it to get people interested in the topic.
Yeah, Kelly, I was curious about something you said very early on, that religion is pretty much regarded as a spandrel. It's not evolutionarily necessary or even useful. Is that contested at all in what's theorized? I mean, one could imagine arguments that, well, you know, religious people on balance have more of a sense of purpose. They are more altruistic, which is good for the species, and so on. So I wonder a little bit about whether you oversimplified that a little bit.
Yeah, it's the dominant view, but it's not the only view. So there is a view that thinks it was selected, and it was evolutionarily useful. And why was it useful? Because one of the most difficult things to explain with respect to human evolution is cooperation. We're self-interested individuals. There's just no doubt about it. And when we get in groups, we like to cheat. And it was hard to get explaining how human beings could get into very good, could live together in peace and harmony. That's a really hard thing to explain for on evolutionary grounds. Well, there's a religious explanation. Human groups that have beliefs in God seem to be much better at cooperating than groups that don't. So one set of studies looked at, in the 19th century, there were lots of communist, utopian communes. And then there were lots of Christian communes and a lot of Jewish communes as well. Religious communes were vastly more successful. They lasted much, much longer. The secular communes didn't last very long. So it looks like people need something bigger than themselves to bind themselves together. But it also looks like human beings might need something like a God watching over us to make sure if other human beings don't see what we do, that God watches over us and he sees what we do, and then you get punished even if human beings don't see it. So there's some sense that having God watch over things. There's also a sense that having rituals that are really costly, those prove that people are willing to pay the cost to be part of a community. And so you have a sense that those people aren't going to cheat. They're not going to try to steal what you have or kill you or rape you or whatever might happen. So there is but it's a minority group that thinks that that evolution, that religious practices, beliefs and practices were evolutionarily successful and they were selected. I think, well, to me, there are kind of non-human predecessors for lots of cooperative behaviors. And whether or not those are altruism is a different question, but there certainly are really interesting, there's cooperation all over in the natural world. You know, little tiny cells can be made up of a gazillion tinier cells. So there's a really vicious, I'm just drawing a blank. Anyway, there's a fish that likes to eat other fish, and it has these little cleaner fish. Wrasse, I think, are the cleaner fish. And the big fish and the little fish have a kind of symbiotic relationship. The big fish lets the little cleaner fish eat all the bacteria around its mouth all the way into its gills. And it signals when it's ready to swallow. The cleaner fish senses when it's ready to swallow and comes out. And they have and there's all sorts of examples of cooperation in the natural world. It's absolutely astounding. So the story of cooperation in the natural world hasn't really been it's just begun to be told.
Okay, I think we're out of time, but Kelly will be sticking around so you can ask him more questions. We have coffee and cookies over near the kitchen area, and let's thank Kelly once again. Thank you.